Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbus and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and of course during the show we'll be joined by our 250-game veteran of the Victorian Premier League and former Notts County man Dean Hennessy, while our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson continues to recover from his bout of poor health. A big shout out to Derek, who we hope will be back on deck next week. But first up, the Socceroos and Olleroos have a massive schedule coming up, with the qualifying hub in June for the Qatar 2022 World Cup and the postponed Olympics coming up as well. And while we've had the national men's coach Graham Arnold on the show in the past, it's been a while, so we're looking forward to welcoming back Arnie to talk through the final preparations for this critical next few months. Of course, there's a stack going on at home and around the world which we'll cover, including a competition which we don't spend enough time on, the Serie A, but with Inter Milan bringing their first Scudetto in 11 years to the San Siro under Adriano Conti. ESPN's Men on the Spot and regular guest on the show, Adriano Del Monte, will join us for the reaction from Italy. And with the A-League hotting up, we'll wrap up the hour with the latest in the domestic top flight, as we always do. In the second hour, Willem will kick off with second edition news and the latest on Socceroos Matilda Central in the wake of another Sam Kerr masterclass for Chelsea. Then, the aftermath of the Super League story is still brewing. The Guardian's man on the Manchester beat, Jamie Jackson, will join us to talk through the fallout from the Old Trafford Glazer protest. What a blow-up that was. We'll cover the rest of the European scene with Dino and I'll wrap it up with stoppage time. But Edge, good to have Arnie back on. I know you know him well from all of your trips over the journey and your close association with the national side. But yeah, it'll be great to talk to him about Olleroos and Socceroos coming up.
Absolutely. He's got a huge challenge ahead of him, not only dealing with the organisational and logistical challenges associated with the pandemic, clashing calendars, you name it. He's got the Olympic Games to prepare for, so it'll be a fascinating chat. But Rob, I'm ready to go, mate. I had my COVID vaccination during the week. I got I felt like I was run over by a steam train for 24 hours, but I'm back. I'm ready to go. Let me out of the country. Let me out of the country, Rob.
Okay, well, mate, just one down, 19 million to go, and we'll all be heading overseas soon. All right, well, Willem, why don't you kick us off, brother?
Let's start in Europe. The Champions League final will be an all-English affair for the second time in three seasons, with Man City to face Chelsea in Istanbul on May 29. Neither side were troubled in their semi-final second legs by either PSG or Real Madrid, with Riyad Mahrez finding the net either side of the half for City.
It's Foden on the left. He is looking for Mahrez! Manchester City double the lead. That is a giant step towards a first ever Champions League final.
Timo Werner and Mason Mount scored the goals for Chelsea. They're looking to add to their 2012 Champions League title, while City are looking to add to their sole European success, the 1970 Cup Winners' Cup. Rob, two worthy finalists, I think. Is there any chance of some flexibility from UEFA to have this one played at Wembley as opposed to Istanbul, given all the logistics it's going to take to get those sides over to Turkey?
Or even a smaller stadium, a purpose-built stadium. I was listening to the BBC and they were talking about lobbying for Villa Park, given that both sides are going to be allowed to have 4,000 fans. Mm-hmm. You'd think that it would just make sense. In other eras, I would have said no, but perhaps maybe. Let's just cross our fingers that there's some common sense.
And will Manchester City's European title be under conjecture or a little bit a bad taste in the mouth, Rob? Because the Premier League and Manchester City have been in court behind closed doors secretly now for the past few weeks, as Manchester City protests the investigation that the Premier League's had into their financials since 2019. City's challenging the Premier League in Britain's civil courts.
It's in the news here, Will. It looks like he's taken over your
where hearings have been held behind closed doors and where publication material has been kept confidential. What's going to happen in relation to their European title or Premier League title trouble here?
There's enough blow-ups around football on the front pages, the back pages, the in-between pages. I don't think City will care, mate. If they win, they'll win. It'll be the first time ever. And
Will.
Good luck to them. The Royal Blues versus the Sky Blues. Mate, I just wouldn't count Thomas Tuchel's mob out, mate. They were very, very good against Madrid.
High drama over at Old Trafford this week. Man United manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has called for fans to conduct themselves in a civilised manner following last Sunday's protest against the Glazer family at Old Trafford. United's clash against Liverpool was postponed after fans broke into the ground and invaded the pitch, the culmination of long-held angst towards the ownership. Solskjaer revealed he'd received a personal apology for the family's attempt to join the Super League, and that he expected a statement from them soon. Rob, we're going to talk to Jamie Jackson from The Guardian later on, as you mentioned, but this has been a remarkable postscript to the Super League saga.
Yeah, it has been, and Jamie Jackson also from The Guardian, he wrote a biography on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well. He's been on the Manchester beat for a long, long time now. He's one of the most authoritative journalists in the world on Manchester United, let alone the whole scene going on around there.
Staying in England, Sam Kerr's 19th and 20th goals of the season have helped Chelsea return to the top of the English Women's Super League with just one round to play. Chelsea lead Man City by 2 points and have a 3-goal buffer and will face 6th-placed Reading in the final match. Having already won the Community Shield and Continental Cup this season, they've also progressed to the Champions League final, where they'll face Barcelona at Gothenburg on May 16. Michael, we have an Australian on the verge of an unprecedented quadruple. This is a huge story in the making.
It's a huge story. She's a superstar. She's our Sam. We love her. And there's no excuse for any Australian not to see her Strato stuff, because live and free in HD on the soccer broadcasting service SBS on Monday, May 17 at 04:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time might be one of the last times that we get to see the soccer broadcasting services in action, Rob. That's SBS, if anybody did...
I suspect that the listeners to this show would know what you were talking about, Michael.
I think they would. But it is good that that's going to be live and free, and anybody in Australia can watch Sam Kerr.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And you're un-Australian if you don't get up and watch it.
Back locally, Jamie McLaren has become the fastest player to 100 Australian National League goals, reaching the milestone in just his 144th appearance on Wednesday night. McLaren's first goal of two against former side Perth Glory made him just the second player to hit the 100 mark in the A-League era.
And there it is, Jamie McLaren, as he's done throughout his A-League career, right spot at the right time, and with his head, it's his 100th goal in the competition.
Earlier in the week, Bobo became the fastest to 50 National League goals achieved in 72 appearances, and he couldn't resist McLaren, a little cheeky dig at Perth in the halftime interview, said he wasn't good enough when he was a youngster cutting his teeth at that club. Michael, he's only 27. We've seen him score goals in this of this tally before, but the thing I've enjoyed this season is he's done what I've been calling on him for years to do more of, and that's to drop back and be involved in the build-up play a little bit more. I don't see him going overseas anytime soon. He's going to stay at City. He's probably got hold of the Socceroos number 9 shirt for now, but you'd think he is, at this point, the most rounded we've seen him as a striker.
Oh, absolutely. He's maturing beautifully.
Kickoff times have been confirmed for the Socceroos for June World Cup qualifiers, with some brutal time slots ahead of those who, like myself and like you guys, I'm sure, will be watching from Australia. The matches against Kuwait, Nepal, Chinese Taipei and Jordan will be played at 7:30 and 9:30 p.m. local time, which equates, if you're on the eastern seaboard of Australia, to 2:30 and 4:30 a.m. The matches will be played between the 3rd and 15th of June and will be broadcast on Fox, KO, ABC and the My Football Live app. But it does get easier from there, guys. That's sort of, treat that as your training for late night matches. From there, it rolls into friendlier time slots for the Euros, and then beyond that, really friendly time slots for the Olympics in Japan.
Now, for someone who's spent a career, made a career of getting up and watching the Socceroos, that 2:30 time slot is such a difficult one.
I reckon that's the hardest.
Do you go to sleep early before it, or do you stay up and go to sleep afterwards? Yeah. What do you do, Rob?
You just don't want to fall asleep during the game. That's the problem. And look, some of my fondest memories are of the 2006 World Cup when my older son Thomas, who's now 20 years old, I still remember he was only 5 years old. He got up for every single match, and we just loved it. But they were back in the days where you didn't have technology to tempt you to turn the alerts off on your phone so that your mates don't ring you up and let you know the score. So you get up and just watch it on delay and then fast forward half time and you get a half a decent night's sleep.
No, so it's gotta be live, doesn't it?
I know.
I think Rob. Yeah. No, Rob. Yeah, no. Our listeners just want to pile on Twitter and I'll.
Yeah, Edge will start that war again because he's usually at the event watching it in real time.
That's right.
Having to dig at those of us have to stay at home and actually get up in the middle of the night. Anyway, let's move along. Is a good segue into our good mate Arnie, who Graham Arnold, the national coach of the Socceroos, Ollie Roos. He's going to join us next. It's first time in a long time. We're really looking forward to that. Stick around. Arnie coming up on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News Talk Sport. We've been waiting for a long time to talk to the national coach of the men's side. We have spoken to him on the show over the journey, but we welcome him back. It's a busy time coming up over the next couple of months. Graham Arnold, how are you, mate?
I'm fine, guys. What, did you lose my phone number?
Arnie, you better be careful when you say that sort of stuff, mate. We'll be ringing you every month. But, mate, look, you've got a massive schedule coming up. We all know what's happened over the past 12 months. Fortunately, in Australia, you know, a lot of that disruption is slowly finding its way to a sense of normality. But it still doesn't take away from the fact that you've got Qatar qualifiers in a hub. You've got the Olympics coming up. To get us started, I want to go back to that announcement about eligible Oli Roux players who are playing in the A-League and that they'll remain at the clubs for the A-League finals, even though there may be a camp for non-A-League base players. Can you take us through the approach to this situation and just how you came to the decision?
Yeah, look, it was great communication between, obviously, myself, the coaches and the clubs. You know, I did plan for to use the March window over in Saudi Arabia to give the kids overseas that are eligible for the Olympics an opportunity and a chance because, you know, last January when we qualified in Thailand, it wasn't mandatory that overseas clubs had to release the players because it was outside of the FIFA window. So we haven't seen a lot of the very good talent that we've got overseas at a young age group. So, you know, Saudi was looking strong. It was looking good that we would go there in the March FIFA window, and that got cancelled. And it just went. And then I went back to another plan, and that was around. And I still believe that we need to give those kids an opportunity because there is some good kids overseas. And so, therefore, I got round to the A-League clubs. I'm watching the A-League players every week that are eligible for the Oli Roux, so I'm seeing a lot of them. I've worked with a lot of them, so I know them well. So it was more about, coming up with a plan for me was about minimal quarantine and trying to, because I do believe this, if a player gets put into quarantine or anyone gets put into quarantine before they've got to try and perform, it's always going to be tough on the mental health. So the kids, so I looked at the A-League schedule, again with myself and Greg O'Rourke at FA, and I just felt that, you know, instead of taking the boys away, potentially the strongest squad away of mixed A-League, mixed from overseas, and taking them away and then those kids missing the final series had potentially, and they would have missed probably six games, which is obviously a lot of games for the kids for their fitness. For them to miss that and to take them away from the A-League finals, but also to put them back in quarantine before, you know, they come back and they have to go in quarantine before we actually go to Tokyo, which was mid-January, then they would lose their physical fitness and probably the joy of going to the Olympics. So, you know, I changed my plan, and that was then we changed it to July 1, that we could get all the team together and all the boys in Japan. So I was reaching out to the A-League clubs that, okay, we'll leave the A-League players here if you will release the boys for early and on 4 July 1 so we can go there and have a 3.5-week camp before our first game at the Olympics.
Arnie, I want to take you back to January of 2020. It seems like a long time ago, but the Olympic qualification tournament, I've been lucky with my work. I've seen a lot of Asian football championships and the men and women, all different age groups. I thought that performance in qualifying the Oli Roux was a very significant one and one of our better performances in since we've been in Asia. The way you managed the squad to get us through, close win against Thailand, the home nation, and then a real ding-dong battle with Syria, it wasn't easy. But just on that experience alone, has that impacted on your thoughts about overage players, whether you'll take any, and will you reward the boys that got the job done in pretty difficult circumstances in Bangkok back in January of 2020? It seems like only yesterday, but so long ago.
Yeah, look, again, it's in an ironic way, COVID has helped with, it's been a disaster for the whole world and with the pandemic, but for these kids, it's given them more game time and more time to get on the pitch. And, I after Thailand, you know, I said to the players, it's all about performance now, and it's all about, you know, doing well at your club to be selected for the Olympics, and that obviously got delayed for a year, and there's been a lot more players that have come on the map over the last, you know, the last 8 months, 9 months, and putting in great performances to break into the Olympic squad, and as I said about the boys overseas. So nothing was promised to anybody that that I would pick anybody. It's down to form. It's down to performance. I will not build the Olympic team around three overage players. I think that, you know, for me, those three overage players have to fit into the younger players' team. And when I say that, I don't want to just pick maybe the best soccer player. Or if you say, for example, I wouldn't just pick Matty Ryan, for example, as a goalkeeper when we've got a great talent in Tommy Glover and Margouche and these type of goalkeepers around Australia and stop those kids' careers. So, you know, we have to be weak in the spot for me to be able for me to take an older player.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to the coach of the national men's Socceroos and Ollie Roos, the junior side, heading to Tokyo in the next couple of months. And Arnie, we are enjoying your insights here, and I guess the fact that you're a group now with the likes of Mo Salah, with Egypt coming up, suggests that you might want to stiffen the spine just a little bit, though.
Exactly, but what great experience it is for our boys. You know, like, I can still reflect back to 2008. And we played Argentina, and they had a front line of Di Maria, Aguero, and Lionel Messi, and Raquel May at number 10.
Fair call.
And we lost 1-0 in about, it was the 78th minute, and the boys played out of their skin. And, you know, when you bump into players who were there that night, or that day, and played against Messi, and that, they still talk about. So it's a great opportunity for the group of players, but also the individual, to take themselves to another level. Show they're being put on a big stage to show what their qualities are and what they've got, and it can be the start of a whole new journey for a player or for any individual, because when I look back at the statistics of what an Olympic qualification does and an Olympic age group does for an individual, the stats are something like very very close. I might add is that, you know, 65 Olympic footballers have gone on to play for the Socceroos, and 56 have gone overseas to further their careers. And that 65 is out of a possible 87 or 86 players that have ever played, that have ever taken the field at the Olympics for the Ollie Roos. So it shows you that the stats are very heavy towards, you know, a kid, an individual that goes and performs well, that changes his life and changes his career.
Let's change tack and talk about the Socceroos, Arnie. You've got a massive, massive qualification, or the completion of the first phase of qualification in the Kuwait hub. It's obviously going to clash with the A-League, and that must be a tough pill to swallow, because obviously the pandemic has forced calendars to clash. But, you know, you've been an A-League coach. You've been in the seat when these sort of things have happened before. Just how have you approached it, and what can you tell us about what's the impact on a player, for example, who wants to play for their club but also wants to play for the Socceroos? And it must be tough at times for players and coaches and people in the industry.
It's really tough. And, you know, my approach was that I needed to get around to the A-League coaches, because they're the ones probably with what I felt when I was in charge at Sydney FC and the Mariners, they're the ones without a voice. They're the ones that have to deal with the situation. You know, I've been harping on for years about, you know, having FIFA windows, so then it doesn't put any pressure on any player, and it doesn't put on any pressure on any coaches. And sadly, that since I've been in charge of the Socceroos and the Ollie Roos, I've probably lost some mates, mates as coaches that I used to obviously play with and get on well with, and it makes it very difficult personally. But I don't make the rules, you know. And again, I went out to all the A-League clubs, I spoke to the coaches, we had a great chat about things, and you know, this year especially, you know, you've got 11 out of 12 coaches that are Australian, and that have played for the, most of them played for the Socceroos, and they know what how important it is to play for the Socceroos, and they've been super supportive. It just so happens that this clash of finals, because normally the finals are in the middle of May and the competition's over, but due to the pandemic, it's been pushed back. But everyone is on side. That the coaches and the clubs and at FA, Greg O'Rourke, the APL with Danny Townsend and Simon Pearce, they're all on side that whoever's picked for the Socceroos, it's an honour for the club that the player gets picked and gets taken away to play for the Socceroos. But, you know, for me, the most important thing was the communication to the coaches around this. And you know, overall, you know, for me, we've got to get in line with the rest of the world. The rest of the world has FIFA windows, freedom of the FIFA windows for international activity during those FIFA windows. Takes the pressure away from the players and from the coaches, and international football makes players better. And at the end of the day, the clubs own the players, and the club, and when the kids go away or the players go and play international football and they get sold overseas, then the clubs get the money, not the national team. So, you know, we should work hand in hand with that and make sure that happens in the future.
Pretty wise words from someone who's been around the block a few times. All right, let's think forward to the Kuwait hub. Kuwait City, one of the hottest cities in the Middle East. I think the temperatures when you and the players will be there will be 50 degrees during the day, overnights of the balmy 35 degrees overnight as a minimum. So it's obviously going to be difficult temperatures, even for the locals. They admit that. Facilities, pitches, services, all of that stuff comes into the equation. But how many can you take more players? What's the size of the squad? And I believe it's 4 games in 15 days. Is that correct?
Four games in 12 days.
4 games in 12 days. So obviously that has an impact on the size of the squad, I assume, and how you approach it.
Yeah, look, I have to – obviously it's important that I take extra players because for two reasons. One is for the – you know, we have 4 games in a very short turnarounds, and also, you know, I have to say, with the risk of COVID, if you know half a dozen players go down, then we're in trouble. So, most important thing for myself and the organisation, and even the A-League clubs, is that we qualify for past this next stage, which I truly believe in. When you talk about the conditions, that's an excuse at the end of the day, because the other nations have to put up with it. Nepal, Taipei, Jordan, Kuwait. And, you know, I've already put a ban on the word that you mentioned that starts with H and ends in T. Otherwise, I'll get fined as well from the players.
Height. You put a ban on the word height.
Exactly. There's only two letters in between. And because, you know, once you start talking about it, it gets into the player's subconscious mind, into their brain, and then, you know, that comes up as an excuse. But, you know, in at the time of June, you know, right through the Middle East, there's 5 other groups that are playing in the Middle East. We are one of them. Yes, unfortunately, we're not playing here in Australia, and I didn't expect when I took over this job that I'd be playing 7 out of our first 8 World Cup qualifiers away from home. But it is what it is, and we just get on with it. And all I know is that that soccer family of players, you know, we're all excited. We can't wait to get back together. And when we do get back together, we're there to excite the fans and bring back that Socceroo brand.
Mate, what a brilliant way to finish, because we all fit income cannot wait. We've got the best of both worlds, exactly. We've got the Socceroos, we've got the Olleroos, we've got the Matildas, a heap to look forward to. And we've got an Aussie coach, a proud Aussie former Socceroo, international player in his own right, and a bloke with plenty of experience without blowing wind up your own, if you know what I'm talking about, Arnie. We are very pleased that you are the man in charge, mate. So good luck with what's coming up over the next few months. We'll be watching you. Excitedly reporting on it as well, mate, and every success to you and the boys.
Thank you, and no luck needed. Thank you.
I like it. Good fortune, whatever happens.
Yeah, fortune favours the brave, and they get to share the spoils of victory, don't they?
They sure will. Graham Arnold, the coach of the Socceroos and the Ollie-Roos, big months coming up. Okay, we're going to take a different tack. We're going to talk about a league that we don't talk about often enough, and we've got Damian Tardio on the buttons, a proud young man of Italian heritage. We're going to talk Serie A. We're going to talk Inter Milan, and they've won their first Scudetto in 11 years with our very good friend Adriano Del Monte from ESPN. Stick around, it'll be a good chat with him next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving, and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We enjoyed our chat with Arnie, but for all of the fans of the Serie A out there, the Nerazzurri, the Black and Blues, Inter Milan, they finally won after 11 years the Scudetto, and we have got our man in Milan, Adriano Del Monte, who has been all over that. How are you, mate?
Going well, mate. Thanks for having me, as always.
No, not at all, Adriano. So I remember being in Italy for my wedding anniversary, my honeymoon in 1991 when Inter won the UEFA.
1991?
Yeah, it was 30-year anniversary.
It's a long time ago, Roberto.
It is a long time ago, Michael. And we jumped in the car when they won the UEFA Cup, whatever it was called back then, and my wife's cousins had the flags out the car, and we drove around in Treviso, around the Duomo, the cathedral there. Milan huge, must have been absolutely going off.
Incredible scenes. Obviously, slightly different given the COVID situation, but it was the first time in a long time that I've seen such a large amount of people come together. But there were cars, bikes, flags all over the town making noise. I was at Piazza del Duomo, where obviously the famous cathedral stands, and it was tens of thousands of Inter fans. Again, probably not ideal given the COVID situation, but it was special scenes and a lot of relief for obviously one of Italy's big three clubs who have been starved of success for the best part of a decade. It was their first piece of silverware since the treble with Mourinho in 2010, so not only their first Scudetto since 2010, but also their first trophy. So a long time coming, but Antonio Conte does it again, 5 top-flight titles in 7 top-flight seasons, one of the world's best, and well, what a team, and well-deserved.
And only 51 years old, he seems like he should be much older than that. And obviously, you know, he did it in his one season at Chelsea, and of course 3 times at Juventus to beat the old lady, where he is so deeply connected. He's a man who understands the nuance and the subtlety of fans and football. That he didn't come out and lord it over the opposition. He accepted and respected the fact that he has that history there. But he's a guy that just lives, breathes football, and just gets the job done. What about Romelu Lukaku, though? I mean, he looked washed up, didn't he? And he didn't win it off his own boot, but without him, there wouldn't have been a title.
Well, no, look, many have been debating that fact here in Milan the last few days. Who was more integral to their success? Was it Conte? Was it Lukaku? And look, obviously, for me, the two key figures, no doubt about it. Lukaku came into Italy with a lot of pressure. Obviously, big money signing coming across from the Premier League, and he had his doubters, but he has proved everyone wrong because his numbers speak for themselves, but also what he was able to do with Lautaro Martinez up top, forming arguably one of the best partnerships up top in European football. And again, as I said, the numbers, he was one of the quickest ever in Inter colours to reach 50 goals. He scored 20-plus goals in back-to-back seasons. He's become the first player in Serie A history since the stats have been taken to score 20 and have 10 assists in the same season. He loves the club. He's spoken openly about how much he loves life in the city, which I can attest to is a great city to live in. So, look, he's really made the most of an opportunity. It looks like he's a new player, a new lease on life. He's happy, he's positive, and he's got the reward. And he's been one of the best players in European football this season. For me, he will certainly win the Serie A MVP award as the best player in the competition. And, well, they're already talking about now building on it next season. They're one Scudetto away from the second star, the 20th Scudetto, so that's already their aim for next season. And personally, I'm really keen to see how they fare in Europe next season as well with another crack at the Champions League.
This is Box to Box. We're talking to Adriano Del Monte, Australian Melbourne boy, but living in Milan. He reports for ESPN, BN Sports. He's all over the city, and he's telling us all about the wonderful victory of Inter Milan in the Serie A, their first in 11 years.
Adriano, I'm keenly now looking. I mean, 13 points they lead at the top of the table into Milan, but let's focus on the remaining three positions in the top four. Such a key position to finish in for, obviously, European qualification. Napoli in fifth positions, 2 points behind Atalanta, Juventus and AC Milan. I mean, can the old lady slip out of the top four?
It's a very good question. And look, they absolutely can. It's been a very disappointing season for Andrea Pirlo, obviously in a very difficult position. This first season thrust into the job days after being given the job of the under-23s. But if you're looking at their run home, they still have to play AC Milan this weekend in the most important of them all. And then there's Sassuolo, Inter and Bologna. So it's going to be a tough run home. They can definitely miss out. And what that would mean, well, we'd require another show for that, because that would be a disaster if Juventus were to miss out on the Champions League. I think Atalanta, of the four you just listed there, I think Atalanta will finish second. The story of Atalanta is incredible. Inter winning the Scudetto is great. Juventus potentially missing Champions League is an epic story. But Atalanta just going under the radar and again going back to the Champions League, given their very limited resources, quite extraordinary. And then Milan, Napoli, even Lazio as well, they've still got a game in hand. So it's going to be very tight in the run-in. Look, in the end, I will tip that Atalanta, Napoli and Juventus will make the top four. I think Milan will incredibly miss out, and incredibly because they were winter champions and top of the table only a couple of months ago. So I think Milan will miss out, but the match this weekend, Juventus-Milan, that's going to go a long way to determining who finishes in the top four.
Adriano, obviously for people that are listening right around Australia, Atalanta, the home city of Atalanta, Bergamo, only a couple of hours' drive from Milan, and was the scenes of the calamity of COVID-19 pandemic in the early stages. So there's so many stories overlay in relation to Atalanta's continued success with not only low budgets, but there's I think everybody who follows Italian football has them as their second team for obvious reasons. I'm interested to get your thoughts on Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He's re-signed for another year at AC Milan, but he's under investigation, I hear, because UEFA suspects that he has some shareholding in quite a large betting agency.
That is correct. There's been word of this here on the ground in Italy for a couple of months now. Obviously, still early stages, no sanctions or no fines at this point, but there is that investigation that is ongoing at the present time. So it will be interesting to see. Obviously, Zlatan has recently signed a one-year contract extension. He will be 40 in October. He's on €7 million. So look, he's still as important as ever. So from Milan's on-field perspective, the fact they've invested in him again for another season, this is the last thing that they want. But yeah, again, the early stages of this investigation ties to a betting operation somewhere here in Europe, and obviously not what you want heading into, you know, and his 20 whatever career season as a professional. But look, for Zlatan and Milan, it's a really interesting time. As I said, they are at risk of missing the Champions League despite their dominance in the early stages of the campaign. And now question marks about Pioli, their manager. Will they sack him? Will they bring in someone else? So Milan, what they've struggled with over the last years is just consistent stability. They've just chopped and changed far too often. And I fear that if they miss the Champions League, what looked like a stable cycle may need to potentially start all over again.
And that will be a blow up at the Milanista if that happens. We can't let you go, though, without talking about the new coach at the Roma, the Eternal City. He's going to replace Paolo Fonseca. He was given his marching orders from Spurs. They then went on to lose the League Cup final. Of course, I refer to Jose Mourinho. He's got his own wonderful history in Italy, of course, at the very club that's won the title this year, Inter Milan, winning the Champions League and the domestic title. How do you think Jose is going to go with Roma? Of course, they're not going to make the finals, they're not going to make the finals, the top six, the European qualification. So, yeah, Jose, your thoughts?
extraordinary signing, this one. Look, the word here was that Maurizio Sarri was certain to become the new Roma boss. We did know that Paolo Fonseca was on the way out. And when that news broke, the fact that within a couple of hours, Jose Mourinho was announced the manager, I can tell you it was an immediate mixed reaction here on the ground. It was a lot of concern, putting it nicely, by some Roma fans, obviously off the back of particularly recent results at Spurs for Mourinho. But then there was the overwhelming sense of a bit of excitement. Again, Mourinho, you know that, okay, maybe we won't get the best of Mourinho on field, but you know that we're guaranteed some drama and plenty of talking points off the field. And a club like Roma, who are a big club in Italy, but really have been eternal bridesmaids, been starved of success, Mourinho does bring some excitement to the capital city. And what I like about the appointment, it is a bold move by the new owners, which, again, may not be the right move in terms of the best choice for the best football to be played. But new owners have come in. They're spending big on a manager. He's going to earn 7 million euro per season paid by Roma, plus another 9 million euro per season paid by Tottenham. So he'll be on 16 million euro, which is the highest paid Roma manager by the length of whichever straight in history. It is incredible the money that they've invested. And I think that shows a sign of, I think that's a sign of what's to come. I think Roma will be bold on the transfer market. I think they will look to bring in some big name players. And I like where they're headed. They're a big club in a big city, and they deserve to be back amongst the Europe's elite.
Well, there's no bigger city in the world than Rome. There's some that are equal to it, but none. Rome is Rome, and it needs to have a team that wins. So it needs to have a big personality, and you don't come much bigger than Jose, do they, Adriano? So we will watch this space, absolutely, mate. One thing's for sure, you'll bring headlines. We know that. Hey, Adriano, great to talk to you as always, mate. We'll get you back on the line when the Euros come around, as we sort of plot around our plans to try and bring an Australian perspective to that great competition, mate.
Looking forward to it. I'll be all over Europe covering that one with Optus, so looking forward to it and plenty to come.
Lovely. We love your work with Optus as well. It's probably the only media outlet that I didn't mention of the very many media outlets that you work for, Adriano, mate. So thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
See you, Adriano Del Monte. All right, stick around. We're going to talk A-League after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Let's wrap up this busy hour with a bit of A-League. But before we do, guys, the clock is ticking. It's a Mother's Day on Monday. Sunday.
Oh, Mother's Day.
Even less time.
It was Monday. Love your mum no matter what. Like the time you left your brother a message on the bathroom mirror with her lipstick and absolutely wrecked it. Did you ever do that? I'm sure I did. This is Mother's Day. Give mum a special fragrance or some lipstick at a special price from Chemist Warehouse. There's Burberry My Burberry 50 mils for just $39.99. Dolce & Gabbana for women, the one, 75 mils, $79.99. Chloe by Chloe, 75 mil, $99.99. And Christian Dior, J'adore, 100 mils for $159.99 if you want to really give mum a treat. Chemist Warehouse is making it easy for you to get to your essential items. You can visit your local store, click and collect to save time, order online and get free shipping on orders over $50. Just get it done or call and ask for same day home delivery. T's and C's and charges may apply. Chemist Warehouse, Willem, have you bought Dishare or something?
I haven't. I think it's going to have to be the J'adore.
Oh yeah, well done. He's going to deeply dig into the pockets with the $159.99.
Or maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. I think you will. Great savings every day. Chemist Warehouse, look absolutely after your mum. A-League.
A-League time. First item on the agenda this week is that Perth's ageing Warriors, Michael and Rob, are out of puff, having watched them on Wednesday night against Melbourne City. I think their season looks just about over. They've got that much vaunted attacking glut of players, basically, but they've only scored 3 goals in their past 6. And Andy Keogh in particular looks like he might unfortunately be over the hill for mine. He's 34. He's had 11 starts this season, 16 appearances all up for Duck Eggs, 0 goals, unfortunately. Bruno Fornaroli, 33, has had 18 starts for 8 goals. So the output's there, but he has been nowhere near his dominant self this season. And Diego Castro as well. He's 38. He scored twice from his 11 starts. We know it's not all about the goals for Diego, but I'm not a fan of that roaming role he plays. I think when he's on the left side, you know, he's still got to play in a structure, and I think that's when he's at his best. But when he's just got that license, Michael, to do as he pleases, I don't think he's so effective It was made even stranger by seeing Nick D'Agostino and Carlo Armiento, two guys who have had breakout campaigns, on the bench. Chris Economidis is back, which is a great sign, but I think it's time for Richie Garcia to spend the rest of this season getting more minutes into those guys. And
D'Agostino, for example?
D'Agostino and Armiento. And particularly, I think, Keogh, the end in the A-League might be near.
Interestingly enough, a lot's been said this year about inexperienced coaches. We've directed plenty of heat towards our friends at Melbourne Victory and about appointing inexperienced coaches. Richie Garcia has a fantastic pedigree and a wonderful CV of volume of work in his career, but he is an inexperienced coach. I just wonder if an experienced coach was at Perth, whether their results would be better. What do you think, Rob? Yes or no?
I think you've got to blood them, and Garcia has got a fair pedigree on the pitch. He's done some good things. They did well over in Asia in that bubble.
He didn't do an apprenticeship like Patrick Kisnorbo, for example.
No, he didn't, but... You know, they still have a couple of games in hand. So let's say they win those. They're on 25 points. They're on the fringes of the six. So, yeah, they've got ageing players. I think Willem's outlined that pretty clearly. I think that's probably the bigger issue than the coach. So, yeah.
I think Richie's done the right thing. I think when you're a young coach and you come into an older dressing room, you give them a chance. You don't just put the broom straight through them. He's given all those guys a chance this season. And I think that as the season's wearing on those older legs, they're starting to let him down a little bit. So if I was Garcia, I'd start to look elsewhere. Rob, it's a huge point and juncture of the season, and there's been a 6-point clash just gone. It was Brisbane against Western United on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. That was a genuine 6-pointer, and it was a thriller as well. So Brisbane are looking comfy in the six at the moment. There's another one to come this week, including your boys, the Western Sydney Wanderers. They're up against Western United at Bank West. Another 6-pointer, as I say. So Western United are seventh on 28 points with 19 played. The Wanderers, having beaten Sydney last week in a bit of a surprise, are eighth on the same amount of points and with 20 played. So if the Wanderers win, they've dragged back the deficit of points and matches on Western United. Mm. If they lose, it's going to be really tough. So that's going to be a bumper clash at Bank West on Saturday night. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, and nothing like a derby win to get your confidence back, is there? I mean, we were tracking the decline of the Wanderers, and like everyone watching football in this country had noted how desperate times were for Carl Robinson and his mob, but they got the job done. They led 3-1 late. It was only Bobo's late strike that pulled it back. It should have easily been 3-1 and a very convincing result. So I think the Wanderers and I've said it all along, I think that they're going to play in the finals, and I think we just want to watch that space, because even though the Roar did brilliantly to get that result against Western United in what was an absolute nail-biter, and they'll be there at the pointy end of the season, I still like the Wanderers.
The good thing for the Wanderers, Michael, is it's always when they play against Sydney, despite no matter how badly they've been going, it's always a win against Sydney that gets them kick-started. And they've actually got another one coming up shortly in a couple of weeks' time against Sydney at the SCG. So I still think, I can't agree with Rob on this one, I still think they're going to miss out, the Wanderers.
Yeah, I think they're going to miss out too, but they just keep signing plays. You know, the Scotty Mack factor, he came off the bench and scored with almost his first touch. So, yeah, just an interesting dynamic at Western Sydney at the moment, and a huge match against Western United. That is a massive game.
Next point I wanted to touch on is just a bit of praise for Melbourne City, and you won't hear me say that often as a Melbourne Victory fan, but I think they are now, I'm comfortable to say, certainties to win their first bit of A-League silverware. They lead by 6 points with a game in hand on second and third, and of their seven remaining, they've got five at Amy Park. A critical juncture for them last year, having lost that grand final and then lost Eric Monbiot. We've seen plenty of good sides go close and then fall apart, but they've actually gotten stronger under Paddy Kisnorbo, despite having a little bit of a quiet start. And they're missing Kisnorbo at the moment, who's torn his Achilles, so Des Buckingham is stepping in for now. But yeah, I think they deserve a bit of praise for strengthening post what could have been critical blows in losing the grand final and Monbiot.
Right now, as we speak, Willem, they are the form team of the competition. They look brilliant when they play. They play a beautiful style of football. It's all working for them, and it just seems to be that 3 points is guaranteed each week.
Yeah, well, we've been critical of that club for years, definitely. They've inability to get a crowd into the stadium. Yep. So if they can't get a crowd into the stadium at Amy Park the way they're playing right now...
Especially for finals.
Yeah. And being part of the broader Manchester City football group as well, you know, winning, and we talked to Adam Lafondra last week, Mumbai, fair dinkum those. So
off the park, they've had that strategic move from the north of Melbourne out to the southeast as well.
Okay, A-League, that's a wrap. We're going to talk Steve Keane in stoppage time. don't think we weren't going to discuss that story, him blowing up at Tony Popovich for calling the players of wars. If you haven't heard of that story yet, Ed said the SBS World Game story. Let's stick around for that one in stoppage time. But we've got a lot more before then. We've got Jamie Jackson from The Guardian. We're going to talk the Old Trafford Glazer protest, more Europe with Dino. So that's all after the break on Box to Box.
Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbus and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
Absolutely fantastic!
Yes, welcome back to Box, second edition news shortly. Then a chat we're really looking forward to with Jamie Jackson, the chief football writer of The Guardian. He covers the Manchester beat. We're going to talk about the Glazer protest down at Old Trafford in the wake of Super League. That will be a great yarn. More on Europe with Dino and stoppage time. We will wrap it up. Willem, you've got a stack more to come. Get into it, my friend.
I do, Robin. We've got a huge Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army to kick it off, because we know there's a bumper couple of months ahead. June and July are going to mark a huge return to competitive action for both of our national teams and the Olleroos. And, of course, the Green and Gold Army, Michael, behind the scenes have ramped up their work in preparing future overseas tours. To make sure you're up to date with all news as it comes to hand, sign up to the mailing list at ggatravel.com.au.
I hear he's contacted Alan Joyce and he's getting a Qantas jumbo painted in the Green and Gold Army livery. So expect to see that with all of these Green and Gold Army supporter members of the great organisation planning to head over for their first overseas. So I reckon you'll do it within 12 months. I reckon you'll take a group within 12 months.
I hope so. Matilda's assistant Mel Andretta has this week cast an eye over 26 domestic-based players at the Women's Talent ID camp in Sydney. With those locally-based players having been precluded from joining last month's Matilda's squad, this camp gave them a chance to impress. As reported last week, Michael, the squad included Lisa Devanna, but there were no invites for fellow veteran Michelle Heyman or, interestingly, Sydney FC's Princess Abina. Notable players that were involved as well as Devanna included Kyra Cooney-Cross and Alex Chidiak, and recent box-to-box guests Melina Reyes and Georgia Yeomandale.
Absolutely. Rachel Lowe's in there. I'll throw she's one of the good ones to go into there. There's no question about that. But my mail on Michelle Heyman and Princess Abini is that injury prevented them from participating. But really looking forward to hearing the scuttlebutt from that camp and whether any of those players go through to probably another camp, which is going to happen in Sweden before the Olympic Games. Rob, Lisa Devanna, do you take her? Yes or no?
Absolutely. No question whatsoever. She is the classic football talisman. She's got the energy. She's got the passion. And most importantly of all, she's got the ability. So I think she's the Timmy Cahill of the Matildas, and you just have to take her.
Let's take a look at some of the performances around the globe from the past week. Steph Catley's made her long-awaited return to the pitch, playing the final 10 minutes for Arsenal in their 2-1 win over Hayley Russo's Everton. With just one game to play, Arsenal look destined to finish third. And Michael, you have to think the season is ending a little bit too soon for Steph. She might be a touch underdone heading into preparations for the Olympics.
She might be underdone, but she's a quality player.
Have her in there 100%?
Yeah, I don't see any left-wing player that is going to get close to her if she's half fit.
Melbourne City keeper Tegan Mika is set to return to Norway next season, having signed a one-year deal with top-flight side Ilse Sandviken. Amy Sayer was this week selected in the freshman team of the season for her performances for Stanford University. The 19-year-old holds a lucrative place in Stanford's all-athletics program and was the only non-US or Canadian citizen selected in the side. To the gents, Matt Ryan was back in goal for Arsenal and keeping a clean sheet too as the Gunners beat Newcastle 2-0. Rob, that was his second start in 3 weeks, so Mikel Arteta might just be doing a bit of a thinking about who is his number one after all.
Yeah, and making some good saves, keeping the Gunners in it. I think he is doing everything that he could possibly do. We've heard Arteta's quotes in recent times. He refers to him as a training beast. Mm-hmm. He's putting all the pressure on. So, good news for not only Matty, but also for the national side.
In Denmark, Alma Bill and Midtjylland remain top of the table 2 games into the Superliga's championship round. They're just 4 matches away from winning the title and making the Champions League once again. Over to the States, an unlikely source of goals has come from Brad Smith. He scored twice in the opening 3 for Seattle in the MLS. And to Asia to finish, Aaron Moy scored a genuine bomb for Shanghai Port in their early season draw with local rivals Shenhua. And Adam Taggart has finally pulled on the pink of Soritsu Osaka, debuting against their local rivals Gamba. Back to England, Chelsea.
No comment on Taggart? You're a local fanboy.
Well, I did say Steph Catley might be a bit underdone. I think Adam will as well. He is, of course, the incumbent in the green and gold shirt. He played in that magnificent win they had in their last World Cup qualifier. Yeah, he's got a bit of work to do to get fit. We know that's always the main concern with Adam, but I think he'll definitely be part of the 30-man squad that heads over for the World Cup qualifiers. Moving on, Chelsea have demonstrated some contrition regarding their attempt to join the European Super League by announcing three supporter representatives will attend board meetings from July. The Blues were one of the first teams to pull out of the breakaway 2 weeks ago, with Roman Abramovich stating they'd only joined to stay in touch with the rest. The club will now liaise with unofficial supporter groups for candidates with elections to follow. Rob, you'd suspect that they'd have minimal sway. You hope this is more than just a token gesture, but yeah, it's a step in the right direction nonetheless.
Now, having done a lot of reading and listening and viewing on the whole subject, like most people who were passionate about the game have done in recent times, I'm quietly confident that Chelsea and Abramovich in particular have learned the power of the fans' voice and will actually listen and make some effort, because the one thing's for sure, if they're treated as just mere decorations in these meetings, then they'll come out and let the general public know. So, I know it might be a little naive, but I think that we might be seeing the first shift towards some genuine voice in the corridors of power from the fans.
And it might seem a silly sort of technicality to pick up, but in your reading, have you found it, are they going to actually be board members, or are they going to be just sort of decorations sitting there, just attending the meetings, or are they officially going to be on the board?
Yeah, I think the latter is the impression that I get. But again, looking more broadly at the purpose of Abramovich owning the club in a similar way to City, that he doesn't need the money. He's doing it for prestige. And yeah, look, you know, those who are cynical, and I think with plenty of reason to be so, call sports washing the motivation. But whatever it happens to be, if they've learned their lesson, then it's got to be good for the fans.
Former Arsenal and Germany goalkeeper Jens Lehmann has been removed from Hertha Berlin's supervisory board after calling footballer-turned-pundit Dennis Aogo a quota black guy. Lehmann sent the WhatsApp message directly to Aogo himself, who posted a screenshot on Instagram. Hertha president Werner Gegenbauer, that's a great name, Michael, has said such statements are in no way representative of the values Hertha stand for. We've all sent messages to people that, you know, might have been the wrong person at the time, but we haven't all sent racist messages to the actual victims themselves.
Have you got his explanation that he was trying to sort of explain that he said he was a positive member of the quota and it was a good example for other people of his community?
What's the analogy when you start digging yourself a hole? If you better stop, because you might dig it deeper.
Yeah.
I think
poor old Jens.
He might get out of that.
No, he's going to struggle for years to get into Kigisni. I mean, if that's the way he thinks, then maybe he's getting
his just desserts. Any reflection on German community at all, do you think? Or is it just a outlier, sort of a crazy bloke? Or is it more sort of ingrained in the German community? What do you think?
Oh, no, I think he's representative of a type of thinking rather than a nationality. I think, there's good Australians, bad Australians, there's racist Australians, and there's open-minded Australians, the same as... Germans do have a fair track record for making some bad decisions. We don't need to go there in too much detail, but, you know, they seem to have learned a lot over the past several decades. So, you know, he's got his right whack and he's going to suffer for it.
I want to head over to Japan, although it's been early in the J-League season, Michael. It's been a massive week in determining how that season might just play out. I've watched a fair bit of it and really enjoyed it. Kawasaki Frontale have firmed to win their second successive title after dominating their main competitor, Nagoya Grampus, in back-to-back league matches. In a fixture quirk, Japan's two best sides met twice in 5 days, with Kawasaki making Nagoya look pretty second-rate, in my opinion, winning 4-0 and 3-2. Having conceded just 3 goals in the first 12 games, Mitch Langerak's Nagoya conceded 7 across these two. There is still a long way to go, but yeah, after 14 rounds, Kawasaki do lead by 9 points. And elsewhere in Japan, Pete Klimovsky has landed another job, this time with J2 club Montedeo Yamagata.
Fantastic for Pete. We wish him all the best. But Kawasaki, a lot in Australia anyway, doesn't get said about them. But they're a super club, a super power of that competition. They just keep going. Just more broadly on Japan, Rob, I noticed that public health experts are becoming more and more outspoken in Japan about the Olympic Games and whether they're safe to stage. Their vaccine rollout's been going very slow. We're only about 1% of the public's been inoculated. The Japanese medical system's recently come at a strain for new cases of people being hospitalised. I think Games organisers need 10,000 medical workers to stage the game safely, in particular 500 registered nurses. And the union said they won't make those nurses available because of the impact on the health system should they be sucked out of the health system to support the Olympics. And deaths in Japan are now surpassed 10,000. So that information against the backdrop, do you really think the Olympic Games are going to happen?
Yes, I do. I think the world...
Even with that?
I think,
in September?
Yeah. I think 18 months on from...
There's a federal election in September in Japan.
The world is doing what it needs to do to live as close to a normal life as it can possibly be done, and that the resources of the entire world community are being put into play to make this happen. So I think if there was one country in the world you'd want it to be in right now, it's Japan, because they behave themselves, they do what they're told.
That's our perspective, isn't it? But what if you're a Japanese national and
that's just an opinion.
Every variant of the virus is going to come in with the Olympic Games participants, you know?
Yeah, I don't necessarily say that my opinion is right or wrong, or it's the right decision or not. I just think it's going to happen.
What do you reckon, Willem?
I tend to side with Rob whether it's appropriate or not. I think they're this far down the track. There's no means really to move it or cancel it. I think we'll be seeing it going ahead. And a sad one to finish, medical experts have deemed Diego Maradona received deficient and reckless healthcare before his passing last November. Prosecutors ordered an investigation into Maradona's medical team, with the 70-page report now finding he was not properly monitored in the 12 hours leading up to his death. So no winners out of that one. Rob, I'm sure the great man is resting with a big smile on his face.
Yeah, well, you know, if he's got a big TV and... He's got a lounge and a disco and all the entertainment that he needs, then, well, I hope he is. But I do think for a bloke who was a self-confessed drug addict and alcoholic, who lived a life so far in excess of any excess than most people could even imagine, that you can't blame the doctors. Diego's got to cop the responsibility for this.
Willem, the people I talk to in heaven tell me he's looking for Pelé. He still can't believe he died before Pelé. He thinks Pelé's got to be there somewhere.
Okay, keep looking, Diego. He might be joining you there in the next few years. Anyway, well,
do you talk to people in heaven, Rob?
Yeah, well, I do. Yes, I'm a man of a deep faith, so I talk to my mother all the time.
Good.
Yeah, ask her for some help along the way.
Bubble ganoush as well.
Oh, yeah, we had some good leb food last week after the show.
Did we ever?
For sure.
Yeah, outstanding. We did.
All right, well done, boys. Okay, after the break, we're going to talk to Jamie Jackson. He's from The Guardian. The Super League story rolls on. This is another iteration of it. It's the Manchester United blow up at Old Trafford. The Glazers, worst owners in world football, are they? We'll ask Jamie and find out on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving, and more.
And this could be the most crucial.
This is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, Talk Sport. Now, like everyone else in the football media, the football loving world, we've been gripped by the European Super League story over the past few weeks, and it looked like it died down a little bit until the supporters of the Manchester United turned up at Old Trafford and staged a protest which stopped the game against Liverpool. We had been hoping to talk to somebody of great knowledge on the subject, and we found exactly that man. He's the chief football writer with the Guardian in Manchester, Jamie Jackson, also the author of The Red Apprentice, the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer biography. Welcome to the show, Jamie. How are you, mate?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, we're really good, Jamie, and as you know, there's a massive diaspora of fans and supporters of the Premier League in Australia, as there is all around the world, and there's no club supported with more enthusiasm than Manchester United, and to see that it's such a big game. I mean, that match against Liverpool had so much riding on it, let alone the fact that it's one of the great sporting events of the world. In your opinion, was this an opportunity for the supporters to finally seize the day in the wake of the Super League story and just vent their spleens at the Glazers and get it on the public record around the world?
Yes, I mean, the profile of the game, you know, Manchester United v Liverpool is obviously their biggest game, United's big game, also Liverpool. The fact that if they'd have lost, Manchester City would become champions, they was on a bank holiday weekend, all added to this sort of profile, you know, the world is watching kind of thing. But also, the ESL, the now defunct European Super League, had basically heightened you know, these fans, these supporters, dislike, disaffection with regard to the Glazers' ownership, which has been festering for 16 years. You know, the illegality, the trespassing, the sort of breaking to Old Trafford, the police officer who sadly got slashed, that's all absolutely bang out of order. And as Solskjaer was saying yesterday in press conference, you know, a police matter as it should be. But, you know, putting that to one side, the actual, you know, what's at the root of this is, as I say, a 16-year disaffection with the Glazers' ownership. Obviously, they bought in 2005, and I don't think it's going away. I think, from what I'm told, there's no concrete plans at the moment for another protest, but there will be others. For example, I'm just trying to remember this because it's been rearranged, but I think Leicester now is the next game at home game is Leicester on Tuesday, and the Liverpool one, the rearranged one, is Thursday. This is Thursday week, 2 days after Leicester. So there's two opportunities. So let's see what happens.
To add insult to injury, of course, for United fans, the noisy neighbours are winning everything. And even though their owners got involved with the Super League, the Abu Dhabi group have invested a lot in the area and turned what was a part of town that was downtrodden. And it's the exact opposite of what the Glazers have done. Glazers are still ripping out dividends from the club when it's making a loss. So that just adds a piquancy to the whole thing. To just outrage the supporters on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, if you just consider that at the moment the debt remains $455 million plus, in terms of interest payments to service that debt, that's obviously the debt that they loaded on the club to buy it. It's like, you know, what's known as a leveraged buyout in 2005. It has been £1 billion plus just to service that debt. So my math isn't great, but that's basically £1.5 billion, which, you know, the club has lost, effectively, which makes it all the more remarkable that, you know, for the sort of 8 years under the Glazers' ownership that Ferguson continued to retire, I think we basically have, if not their most successful, basically one of them periods. You know, they won, I think, five Premier Leagues, Champions League, some domestic cups. But imagine where they would be now, you know, with that money. But it's, as you're basically indicating, that it's not just about the money. It's about the lack of sort of real investment in the club as a club. There's no heart, there's no soul. And yeah, this is what was interesting for me. So after the ESL blew up, you know, became defunct and United pulled out of it, Joe Glazer, one of the co-chairmen, apologised unreservedly, to use his words, and said they wanted to listen more. Well, cut to sort of yesterday, 2 days ago in Florida, there's a Sky News team, you know, a journalist there. I think it was Avram Glazer, but forgive me if I've got that wrong, but one of the Glazers, she had very diligently tracked down anything to say to the United fans. He didn't say a word at all, not even no comment. I mean, this is the thing, you see, when there's a silence, into that void, all kinds of interpretations are sort of, you know, come about. And that just, again, it just comes across as disdain, especially as I just said, they promised to listen and speak. Now, no, from what I'm told, they're still formulating how best to deal with this. There are conversations going on, but there's nothing public. I mean, that apology I just mentioned was, I think, the first time fans have been directly addressed, really, since an initial interview in 2005. I mean, you know, you've got to ask the question, why would you not want to speak to your own fans? What is that about? I mean, you know, they have a perfect arena. There's an official United fans forum. It has 10 or 11 fans on it who represent different areas of Old Trafford, so the match day going fans. That's convened, I don't know, two or three times a year. Surely one of them has got it within their compass just to speak to that maybe once a year. Just take some questions.
Yeah.
I just don't understand who's advising them.
I look to the future and think, you know, what actually can happen to placate the fans in relation to their objections about the ownership? And there's really nothing more than the Glazers selling the club, which there seems to be no prospect of. But how dynamite is this issue? And off the back of the Super League calamity, does this have the potential to escalate into a full-blown sort of diplomatic or political issue between England and America on the basis of the you can feel the disdain, contempt, and almost hatred the fans have of the owners. And like you say, rightly, they don't seem to be wanting to engage in any relevant or appropriate form of dialogue to address some of these concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I'm told that they believe Manchester United as a club, an entity, a business concern, if you like, could you know, that they could grow it to be worth minimum $10 billion. And actually, dollars is how it was characterized to me. But I think actually, it could go beyond that to say £10 billion. So they're not going anywhere. So that sort of answers basically the first sort of part of your question with regard to that. That's, you know, that's fans 100% first choice. Just sell up and off you go. Thanks for not too much. And we'll move on. But beyond that, if that's not going to happen in the short term future, and the only thing I'd add as a caveat is football, you never know how how anyone's thinking, really. But, you know, beyond that, it's kind of what I mentioned. If they would just actually speak to the fans and actually sort of say, look, we are sorry, you're right to feel cheesed off. You know, I'm being polite there, obviously. It's been 16 years of basically disregard. We are sorry, and keep on taking questions until, to a certain extent, you've allowed people just to have a proper say. I'm not saying that's going to make the Glazers popular. I don't think it will. But what I'm saying is, from their point of view, if you've got anything about them, if they actually do mean what they said in that statement, that apology, that's what I would be advising, to actually properly engage, make good on your promise. Now, maybe this will happen. Yeah, maybe this will happen. We are only 2 weeks, I believe, since the ESL and etc. But, you know, just going on the Glazer yesterday or 2 days ago in Florida doesn't seem like he, you know, anyway. But in terms of a diplomatic thing, I don't know. I'm not too sure it'll become too ratcheted up beyond the fans and the Glazers. I mean, I tell you what they would like, and it's, to a certain extent, all football owners get it in the neck a little bit when the team's not doing well. If you look at Abramovich at Chelsea, okay, I'm not saying he's perfect or anything like that, but in terms of a profile of an owner who doesn't really say much, but puts his own money into the club, that's what we would like. You know, if the Glazers, if it was the way around, if they put, you know, half a billion or whatever it is that Abramovich has done, probably more actually, then the fact they don't say anything becomes immaterial, because it's you know, they're putting the money where their mouth isn't, if you like. But they're getting nothing. In fact, it's the reverse. They're getting nothing, and they're having money drained from their club. And, you know, Manchester United, I'm not a fan of the club. I'm not really a fan of any football team. I'm sort of like a lap starting a Forest supporter when I was a kid. But my son is, where I live, is a big Manchester United area. And as you just said, Australia, the reach of the club, it is a cultural phenomenon. But at heart, you've still got these fans who really care about it being the club that it was, the tradition. You know, Ferguson, Matt Busby, it was formed out of a sort of railway workers team, Newton Heath, which is in the sort of northeast of Manchester. You know, that's where it was originally. So they care about these things, and I think that's right. I think anyone really who's right-minded believes that, you know, there is a football club's a bit like a church, really. Mm. You know, it's like it's got a soul to it, it's a community sentiment, and the Glazers just, I think they've been so errant in the way in which they've dealt with this. Listen, they're American, they don't have the local ties. I understand that, but it's such a great club to sort of be a part of. I'm surprised they haven't really more enjoyed the process. It almost seems like they kind of want to avoid anything to do with it, which is odd.
Well, they're not football people, are they? I mean, they're American football people. They've got deep roots in the NFL. They see this as a commercial transaction. I mean, Abramovich, obviously he's looking for political acceptance, but at least he's a football person. He's seen at games supporting, cheering. He gets down and sees the development squads train and play. So I think that's even worse for Manchester United fans, the fact that they've just got this, you know, titan, you know, sports franchise owners out of the US that are just buying them for pure commercial reasons. And I guess that's at the core of what all this is about. And fans all over the world, they're hurting. The Manchester United fans are hurting out of the ESL stuff, out of the Super League debacle, probably more than any others, I'd say. Yeah.
Gary Neville, for example, would be the perfect owner for them. I'm not saying he wouldn't get flack, but, you know, he'd be engaging with supporters. It'd be a two-way thing. It'd be a really healthy, sort of vibrant relationship. You understand what I mean? And it would be fun. Fans wouldn't care if the team were losing or if you didn't get this player, because a figure like Gary Neville, or even say a Solskjaer, you understand what I mean? Someone who, now these people don't go on trees because they have to come with the requisite. I mean, at the moment, the club's worth about $3 billion. So, you know, that doesn't go on trees. But you understand what I'm saying? But what I think is, you say there about that they're not football people, but I don't even think they're sports people. If they were sports people, it wouldn't matter that you know, football or soccer, as they call it in America, wasn't, you know, their sort of true love. They would love sports. It's interesting that they've just won the Super Bowl at Tampa Bay, basically with a player who was one of the all-time great, Brady, but they basically got him because he was released by the Patriots. You know what I mean? It wasn't like they went out and got, right, went, right, we want the sort of Kylian Mbappe of the NFL, or we want the Leo Messi. You got a guy who was considered not washed up, but, you know, surplus to requirements, and it was clever. But I'm saying that's kind of a classic Glazer sort of thing. Now, what I would say is, and this is correct, this is true, it's a fact that their £200 million spend in the last 2 years is the most of any club basically in the world, because it's most of it in Europe, which obviously dwarfs anywhere else. But this is the whole point: his message does not, it's not come across because of all the other stuff, because he won't engage. Because it's probably another way around. I'm seeing quite a lot of stuff over here, but it's in Australia, that fans are actually saying, you know what? So the protest, for example, on Sunday, if we get deductive points, do we really care? No, because we want these people out. And that's the strength of feeling. That says to me, for them, it's beyond the short term, oh, we need to win, we need to beat City, we need to be in love, which obviously they want to do, that's what it's about. But, you know, this is how sad it's become. They actually just want anything to get rid of these people. And it's, I don't know, really, it's a shame. It's a shame on all sides. I think the Glazers have kind of come across a little bit of, they've lost where they should be. I don't really think they should be involved in this in United, because, yeah, for them it's a business, but it is, as you're saying, it's not just a business. It comes with a whole responsibility to fans who are basically the club. It's an obvious thing to say, but if you don't have fans, we've seen this with lockdown, you don't have fans at grounds, you don't have fans loving a football club or any sporting entity, whatever it might be, you know, then what you're left with, really, you're left with a load of, you know, sort of a shell of an entity.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what it's all about. It's the lack of empathy, the lack of care, the fact that they just don't seem to be interested, and they're lucky that they've got a red devil through and through in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who's not only central to so many of the great stories over recent times of Manchester United, but he's also getting a tune out of the squad and getting some decent results. Hey, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We encourage all of our listeners, Manchester United supporters or otherwise, to get a hold of The Red Apprentice. It's a great read, and you can get it online, and you'll enjoy it. No, not at all, Jamie. And we obviously do plenty of reading on The Guardian as well, and read your copy too, mate. We thoroughly enjoy it, and mate, we hope we can have you back on again soon, mate.
Of course, anytime. Thanks ever so much. Thank you.
No, brilliant. Good on you, Jamie. Stay well. Jamie Jackson from The Guardian. Manchester United, okay, the Glazers, that story's not going anywhere. All right, we'll continue with Europe. Dino's going to jump on the line next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box on Nine Radio, NTS News, Talk Sport. It's been a busy show, but for the first time this show, we welcome our great mate, Dean Hennessy. How are you, Dino?
Very good. How are you?
Yeah, really good, mate. So we've
King
covered
Ram.
Off...
King Ram, he's back. Dino, the Ram.
We've covered it, yes. We'll
get to the Derby County in a little while.
I know, it's a bit nervous times for Dean. So we've talked City R, we've talked to Jamie Jackson before the break about Manchester United, but what we want to talk about is some of the football on the puck, for a change. The Champions League... The results were starkly different. I mean, PSG imploded, and Manchester City took their rightful place, as seems destined, in the final of the Champions League. But Chelsea under Thomas Tuchel, geez, they just are developing, and they will be a serious threat, obviously, having beaten them already a couple of weeks ago, Dino.
Look, it was a superb performance. Thomas Tuchel's... what he's done in the time he's been there, as we all know, that Frank brought a lot of these players in, but, you know, and they got off to a really good start early in the season. I think they were top in December.
Yeah, well, Frank deserves credit for getting them qualified, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, you know, and he brought the team together, but then obviously something went wrong, so we both probably don't know exactly how that all came about, but when Thomas Tuchel came in, it's just changed the whole place. I mean, they've lost one game, I think, in the league, which was that West Brom debacle when they had the
clean sheets.
But outside of that, they've been just unbelievable, clean sheet after clean sheet, and they thoroughly deserve to beat Real Madrid. I thought Real Madrid looked aged and almost finished.
The result for City against PSG, the way that PSG imploded, they're almost a caricature of themselves when this sort of stuff happens. I mean, admittedly, they didn't have Mbappe and they were coming from behind, in that tie, but it just all went pear-shaped pretty much from the outset, didn't it?
Yeah, look, it did. I mean, again, City, quality team. And I want to really raise the profile, I guess, Mahrez, because we're always talking about the De Bruyne's and, and all the others, but this Mahrez absolutely dominated this game. And he's just, he did it at Leicester and won a championship. He's now doing it regularly. For me, he's one of the best players on the pitch.
Well, he's turning up every week in, week out, isn't he? He was a bit of the type of player that came once every three or four matches, but now he's doing it all the time.
It's week in, week out now, Rob. You're spot on. It's a pleasure to watch him. He's so good, and he just knows where to be. It's just unbelievable time. And look, to be fair, they're playing some really good football, City.
Well, look, let's look at the Premier League briefly before we take a look at the Championship, because this weekend is the last round of the Championship and it's all to play for in terms of relegation and promotion. But City have got the job done, and I think what we're really talking about here is who will secure those last few spots for Europe, and the relegated side seem already decided.
Man City, they look like champions. I think there's no catching them.
United can catch them mathematically, but it's not going
to
happen.
And I think United will go all the way to push as many points as they can. But obviously they've got other things on their mind as well, obviously winning some silverware as well. Leicester, they're in a good position. But Chelsea, as we've already mentioned Chelsea already, they're right on the heels now. And West Ham, not too far away, only 3 points behind. And then Tottenham, with that Gareth Bale hat-trick. To be honest, I don't know if you saw the goals, but the goals were unbelievable, all three of them. And I think we don't leave even Liverpool out, because they've got that game in hand that pushes them to that 57 mark. But outside of that, Everton aren't going to trouble it, I don't think, now. I think they're just a little bit too inconsistent.
Edge, you want to jump in?
Oh, I just wanted to jump in because Richard Scudamore, the former Premier League CEO, gave a very rare public interview to Gary Neville on Sky Sport in the UK, where he said that there must be consequences for the six clubs, the Super League clubs. Now, what consequences means, or whether that means punishment, I don't really know. But Scudamore is actually advising the 14 non-Super League clubs. His direct quote is, "I cannot explain why any of them thought it was a good idea. I am the person who'd been telling them for years it was a crazy idea and could not happen. What's happened in the last week is that it's been stopped. And that's the right thing. There has to be some consequences. I think something will have to be extracted by way of undertakings, or at least a change in attitude." So that's from Richard Scudamore, who very rarely speaks publicly, and so that was a significant thing. And I just wonder whether consequences or punishment for the Big Six, whether that will actually transpire, and if it does, what it would be, Dino.
Yeah, look, I think if he was still in charge, and obviously, he's come out now in public with this statement, he would have done something about it. Now, whether the top brass now, running the Premier League, have got the, because for me, it was a total trust issue, for the fans, for the players. They had players and coaches being asked questions, and they had no idea what was going on, most of them. And it just looked really, really bad. But the good thing is that at least they all did pull out eventually, and they did it on their own esteem, even with a little bit of pressure. So my worrying thing is a little bit about the Man United, where they're going to have some more stoppages and maybe going and that was a poor look last weekend, and that's what we don't need, really. So for me, I don't know. I think there should be some form of punishment. What it looks like, hard to tell.
So, Dino, we'll move on to the Championship. It's the final round before the playoffs for the final spot in the Premier League. But the one big match, and we really didn't see this one coming necessarily, did we? I mean, we've been talking about Derby and whether Rotherham would be the problem, but Sheffield Wednesday now have moved into the box seat. The goal difference, there's just one apart. So if Sheffield are sitting in 23rd spot, they're on 40 points, but Derby County are on 43. So if they win, they pretty much leapfrog Rotherham and Derby County and stay in the championship. And Dean,
they do.
What I mean, Derby have just been spinning down the spiral.
They have.
And Wayne Rooney, everyone is a critic these days. He was the wrong person, too inexperienced, shouldn't have got the job. But they weren't saying that when he was first appointed, were they?
No, they weren't. I mean, look, he was player coach as well, where that's never easy to do, but he saw the light with that. And realistically, I mean, I'm surprised that they aren't down here. But if I look at it and I've analysed everything, I did a scenario that basically Derby v Sheffield Wednesday. Derby need to win, draw or lose because they can still lose and stay up. Right.
Mm-hmm. I do like your assessment there. They need to win, draw,
or
lose. One of those three is going to happen.
Yes, exactly. So Cardiff and Rotherham. Rotherham win, Derby must win.
Mm-hmm.
Cardiff, Rotherham. Rotherham draw, Derby stay up.
Mm-hmm.
So if they draw, they stay up. And then with Wickham, very, very unlikely with a goal difference. It's just a matter of unless they're going to go and score 8 goals away from home and turn that goal difference. All Derby really have to do is just get that result against Sheffield Wednesday. So, again, that's the scenario. But I think Derby at home and Sheffield, all right, they're there. But I mean, a draw's not going to help Sheffield. They're going to have to win.
So, Dino, just explain to me again, if Sheffield Wednesday beat Derby County, how can Derby County stay up?
They can't.
There you go. Win or draw. So it all comes down to that, Dino, and I wish you all the very best on...
He's so insincere, Dean, and
a lot of the Nottingham Forest fans have a lot of sympathy at the moment.
How's your phone going? Has it been running hot? Richard Rudsky Beckett
been,
and...
Yeah, Bucket's been giving a little bit, but we can deal with that.
The King Ram himself, I tell you what, they have... what a game. What a game it's going to be, Dino.
Well, they'll be ramming it here and ramming it everywhere if they lose, mate.
I know.
It's obviously around about 10 o'clock on Sunday night.
I may go into hiding.
Listeners, we're going to be putting Dino on suicide watch. So we're rostering shifts at Dean's house to make sure he's going to be okay.
You'll be right, Dino.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident they'll just pull it out the fire for some reason. I don't know why.
We'll all be watching it together, mate. All right, Dino, stick around. We're going to talk... stoppage time. We're going to talk Steve Keane. If you haven't seen this article, it's outrageous. Very upset with the new coach coming in at Melbourne Victory, Tony Popovich. So, Dino, you just sit tight there, mate. We're going to talk about this after the break on Box to Box.
Okay, lovely.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We hope you've enjoyed the show this week. It's been jam-packed. Graham Arnold, Adriano Del Monte, Jamie Jackson, of course, Dean Hennessy. He's still with us, though. It is stoppage time. The fourth official's given us about 7 minutes before we get into this story with Steve Keane and Tony Popovich. Storage King. Is your home running out of space? Then call our very good friends at Storage King. If you're decluttering, moving or renovating, downsizing, creating a home office post-COVID, so many people are finally realising you've got to get that extra space. So make the decision now. Make the space with Storage King. They have got the answer. They've got stores everywhere. Locations just around the corner. They've got storage professionals who will help you with everything. Go to storageking.com.au to find your nearest store and give Storage King you back some space. Nice whistling there, gentlemen. I like it.
Thank you.
Willem loves that jingle.
I do indeed.
They're the kings of the storage business.
Biggest in the nation.
There's a million reasons why you'll need us.
With only one solution.
Oh, he's done well. Well done. All right. This Edge sent this story to us. I had to laugh. I couldn't believe. I mean, Steve Keane, he's a professional and he's been around for a long, long time. But dropping the bucket from the height that he did on Tony Popovich, Willem, was surprising.
Yeah, Rob. So he slammed Popper as unprofessional and out of order. He's alleged that Popper's been shaping what will be Tony's squad for next season without informing Keane. He's been giving a few players the tap on the shoulder ahead of time and making his intentions clear. Last week, Keane told journos he was in control of squad selection and youth opportunities for now. And yeah, he's agreed that Popper's undermined this. Well done to Joey Lynch for breaking this one on ESPN and the World Game as well. Look, everyone knows Popper is taking a huge broom through everyone and everything at Melbourne Victory that he thinks needs to be done. And I think that Steve Keane is going to be a big part of that. I don't know why he's opened his mouth here. I think he's been there for 5 minutes. I think he's going to be irrelevant in another five. And I just don't understand why Keane's opened his mouth here.
Dino, the bit of the article that sort of grabbed my attention wasn't so much what Willem said, but Steve Keane said that he tried to ring Popovich and Popovich didn't pick up or has not returned his phone call. What do you read into that, Dino?
Obviously not too much respect for him.
I'd say that's what it is.
So, Dino, you're the coach amongst us. Surely what Popper's doing happens all the time. Every time there's an interim coach, it's just de rigueur. So why would Steve Keane be surprised?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know Steve Keane. I mean, I know of him. I know what he was like in England. And obviously then when he came over to help Rebs out over here. I don't really know. I'm not close to it. But from my point of view, Tony Popovich, and this is, if they're going to do a rebuild, which I think they're going to, that's exactly what they are going to do. You can't just sit on your hands and let all the opponents who are in the same league being able to talk to people and try and bring people in. He wants to do that himself and he wants to do it now. And unfortunately, with that caretaker role, that's what it is. It's a caretaker. And realistically, it doesn't look like Steve Keane is going to be there for next season. So I'm quite surprised why he put his head above the parapet, you know, because I just don't know why. Because that's what everybody does, and you can't really blame Popper.
And an additional point, Steve Keane's dragged JP to Marini into this as well. He said JP's also in the dark and hasn't been contacted by Popper, so that probably doesn't bode too well for JP's future at the club either.
I mean, that sounds like he's already going to go for somebody else and bring his own assistant and backroom staff, and that's what most coaches do. They want the right people that they believe and can trust, and that's a really, really big word in football, of having trustworthy people around you. Because, you know, I've been a coach for quite many a year, and it's quite a lonely one unless you've got really good staff around you.
Yeah, exactly. I can just imagine when Anthony DiPietro got wind of this article, he thought, for God's sake, what's going to happen next? It's just a blow-up at the Victory. This season can't be over.
I thought he was good, though, as well, Rob, you know, DiPietro, when he did the exit for Brebs. I thought he spoke really well.
Michael, Gianni Infantino.
He gave an interview to the great French daily newspaper L'Equipe, which is one of the great publications in world journalism. Yeah. It is an absolute cracker. So,
is that the Della Sport?
Yeah, that one's a good one too. But, I got my best French and dropped the article into Google Translate, and this is what it said. Infantino said, "Perhaps my words will now be better received. Soccer's actors working with political bodies must ask the right questions and propose solutions." That was his response to the question directly relating to the Super League fallout. But he did say that reforms were needed in the sport to ensure that those less fortunate could be better off in the future and bridge the gap between the super clubs. And this is what he rattled off, and some of these hadn't been sort of publicly let out of the bag just yet. So he's talking salary caps, plus caps on transfer fees and caps on agents' fees. That would be a very significant thing if some of that was holistically rolled out right across football generally. Limits on maximum number of players on rosters with requirements for minimum or homegrown players. Limits on the number of games a player can play in a season, along with minimum rest days between games. Reduction in the maximum number of teams in leagues, as well as an expanded Club World Cup, which we've talked about, and also a true revolution, whatever that means, for women's football. So that was Gianni's latest oration from the pulpit, Rob.
And if you don't get the chance to watch Edge in 3D as he's sort of twinkling his fingers, giving us the sort of inverted commas sort of kind of look on steroids. Yes, so whatever that means. I thought that was the word or the sort of statement of the day. Well done, Gianni. You are the ultimate politician in football. Dino, hey, good luck this
salary
weekend.
Cap in the Premier League, Dean, you'd support that?
Yep.
Sorry?
The salary cap in the Premier League.
We've got 15 seconds.
Yeah, look, Dino, to answer. I'll just say I can't see that ever coming in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well done, Dino. Nice answer. Dino, good luck this weekend for Derby.
Yeah, come on, you Rams.
Go on the Wednesday.
Oh, nice one.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Michael. Great show. See you, Dean. Thanks, Damien.
Thanks, Damo. Ciao, Damo. Sitting down there.
Arrivederci.
Arrivederci from the city, eh, man. Himself. Thank you for joining us again. We hope you've enjoyed the show. It's been good fun from our end talking to Arnie and Adriano and Jamie and getting through a bunch of stuff on football on Box to Box. We love it and we hope you do too. So, and we do hope you join us next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.